Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Valley Roundup. Today, we look back at the stories that defined 2018 here in our valley. I'm in the studio with the Aspen Public Radio news team, Zoe Rome. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Allison.
Wyatt Orm. Hi, Wyatt.
Hi, Allison.
And Kristen Kay. Hi, Kristen.
Hi there.
Stay with us as we take a journey back in time. In my mind, there's no doubt that the biggest story of the year, both in the scope of who it affected, how long we've reported on it, the magnitude as to what was at stake for 2018 was the Lake Christine fire. And I'm going to actually start with audio from each of you from the day that that happened. The fire started on July 3rd of this year. Everyone was in town for July 4th, which is when Aspen Public Radio went live with updates.
11 o'clock. I'm Zoe Rome with an update from the Lake Christine fire. The APR news team is bringing live updates every 30 minutes from the field.
The fire. The alert is recommending people prepare for 72 hours without power. Aspen Public Radio's news director Allison Bektesh is on the scene. What are you seeing?
So I'm standing in the little park between Basalt Middle School, the ball field out here, and the fire department, and it's actually a really normal scene for the 4th of July as you drive through Midland Avenue. All the people are standing along the side of the street. Everyone has their picnic blankets in the park. Everyone's looking up at the sky, but instead of fireworks, they are looking at this fire that is taking over Basalt Mountain right now. We're watching the plane.
The Red Cross is planning to provide shelter tonight at Basalt High School. I'm in constant communication with the Eagle County Sheriff's public information.
It's a strange scene in Mid Valley right now. Businesses on the south side of 82 are still operating, and Whole Foods, the parking lot is full, and City Market, the parking lot is full, and you can see that there's out-of-town license plates just like it would normally be around the 4th of July with lots of tourists in the grocery stores.
Aspen Public Radio news reporter Kristen Kay. Thanks so much, Kristen. Stay safe.
Thank you.
Kristen, let's start with you. You were at the meeting that was called the Night of the Fourth. Community meetings, they have these regularly throughout the fire where the most updated numbers for square footage came up, things like where you can stay for shelter that night, any other updates from fire officials, from the Eagle County Sheriff's Office, who was kind of overseeing it the first couple days. Do you remember that crowd? Do you remember that room?
I think there was just such a feeling of uncertainty, and really it had been just over 24 hours since the fire broke out and then really just exploded overnight. And we saw people going through lines to get food in the shelter right next door to where the briefings happened. This was kind of the community's first introduction to the team who would be taking over. And I remember an audible gasp from people when we heard that this fire would take months to burn out. I think that we just had no idea, you know, like the federal team that swoops in and how that all works and then how long these fires really take. A lot of us in the valley haven't had that experience. And so it was sort of our initiation, I think, into this world of wildfire that now we're familiar with and I think really wary of.
Wyatt, we heard the kind of transition, the different parts of the story there. The first day, we thought the whole valley was going to lose power, and that was kind of a story. And then we had that the night of the 4th into the 5th, this huge windstorm that brought the fire all the way down to the Elgibel Mobile Home Park. Do you remember how staying on top of the story and like what the different storylines were?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a constant. It was a constant thing. The fire broke out on the 3rd of July, so on the night of the 3rd. I went and talked to some people and kind of phoned in an update for one of our jazz hosts to read. But as Kristen indicated, you know, it would be the kind of thing where overnight, you know, the fire would, the teams would come back from the field and the fire would spread for, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of more acres. And so, you know, the morning, I remember each morning was kind of like, what's the latest? We need to sort of learn about what happened overnight. I mean, this affected so many people in lots of different ways. The fire was expansive, and so people who lived in Basalt and El Jebel were evacuated from their homes. And you know, even in Carbondale, you could see the smoke. You know, everyone in the valley kind of could see smoke and was impacted by the smoke. So I think that when I think back on the fire, it was really just a matter of kind of just working constantly to make sure that you had the latest information and to try and kind of find the people who were most impacted with the kind of most recent update.
And Zoe, we'd had those 15-minute updates for the first couple of days, and those numbers that we would give would be expanded terrain that was on fire, and we kept on saying 0% contained, 0% contained.
Yeah, it really, I remember being struck by how long it took to reach any level of containment and how quickly the fire caught on and expanded, and then it kind of plateaued once it had gotten pretty sizable, but it truly took them a really long time to have any kind of, well, I mean, it was under control, but not contained for quite some time. And it wasn't even really extinguished until quite late in the fall. In fact, I'd almost forgotten that this is a story we had been tracking until I got the email that they had finally reached 100% containment.
Yeah, sometime late October.
It was after the first snow.
Wyatt mentioned how many people this affected. Of course, everyone who had to leave their homes, but also if you thought you were bringing your kids to daycare that day and daycare is not open because those people couldn't come in and work, or, you know, businesses in Aspen and other places where, of course, you're not coming in to work that day because you're dealing with your house being threatened. Kristen, who did this not reach in the valley?
I don't know that it didn't reach anyone. I mean, I think it was a tumultuous week for a lot of people, especially evacuees. I just have to say, though, that I'm the arts and culture reporter. I've covered a lot of just amazing events, but I think the favorite thing that I've attended this whole year was the community thanks for the firefighters. Mm. It made me so proud to be a resident of Mid Valley, and it was just a moment of people coming together, of appreciation for the heroic work that the federal team and for our local firefighters that they pulled off, and just, you know, kids holding posters and just applause and cheers that wouldn't end. Those firefighters were taking, you know, videos from their trucks because of the outpouring of support. And so I think when people look back at this, they probably will remember that too, that sense of community that this really brought us all together.
Did you find that as well, Wyatt?
Yeah, I mean, I think without a doubt, I think there were, I think that, you know, different people were impacted differently, and I remember, you know, going to the Basalt shelter, and you know, after a few days, you know, people were sort of checking in and out, but there weren't there weren't crowds there necessarily, and then I remember one day where I went from the Basalt shelter to the shelter at Roaring Fork High School in Carbondale. And a lot of the people who had been evacuated from the El Jebel Mobile Home Park, a lot of them are Hispanic, a lot of them Spanish speaking, and the place was totally packed, and it was I mean, there was just a lot. I mean, there was a lot on the line for everyone, but I think that you know, certain people, certain communities, I think were. Yeah, there was sort of a lot on the line for everybody, but maybe you know, people with a lot more on the line, if that makes any sense. And I think that was just one thing that kind of struck me, was not only was the, you know, was the community extremely supportive, but it sort of didn't matter what, you know, how impacted you were. There was sort of a community spirit there for everybody.
It's such a visual story, too. Of course, we work in radio, but the scene that you were just describing, Kristen, I remember the photos of those, you know, the kids and the sign. But right behind that, all the colors of tents, you know, mm-hmm. that the firefighters were sleeping in tents. They were camping, mm-hmm. working all day and coming back and sleeping on the ground, you know, and just kind of these visual moments, those frozen. And of course, the night over the 4th into the 5th, when you take a photo of a fire at nighttime, and that is the only thing that shows up, of course, and it looks so enormous. And I think also visually, I didn't quite understand how close it got to town and how big it was until all the leaves had fallen off the trees and the snow had fallen. And now you drive still, you know, of course, through basalt, and all you see is black on top, and you realize that was all fire. And you couldn't quite see that when there was so much smoke as well. And like, this is going to stay with us.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. I think this is going to be something that is still going to stay with our community. And I wonder, I mean, I've heard a lot of people talking about whether this will be the new normal. Is this wariness in the summer, or, you know, even longer than the summer, about how the West will be affected by wildfire?
Of course, it was a election year that was biggest turnout ever nationwide, and then also here in the Valley. So a lot of people are engaged. There was a ton of statewide issues and local issues on the ballot. There's a lot of people asking for money, Zoe, including the Roaring Fork Transportation Authority, which for the first time will start collecting property taxes for their upgrades and what else?
Yeah, so they're going to be upgrading buses. They're hoping to also pilot a program for electric buses, which have some pretty unique challenges in our valley, specifically being a pretty big area and at high altitude and a cold area. All of those can be hurdles, but they're also investing in WeCycle. They're building trails. They have kind of a lot of different eggs and baskets there. So that money from 7A, from the property tax, they'll be collecting starting January. We'll be going to those several different things.
And of course, that was a decision made in 2018 that will be felt in 2019. I'm curious, you know, not a lot of us are property owners, especially not a lot of us who ride RAFTA in Aspen and Pickens County. You know, like I think you fly in and you drive your car when you're here. If that will continue to affect the rest of us financially, those of us who didn't, you know, you could vote and say, yes, I want better transportation, but I don't pay property taxes. So it was kind of an easy vote. If that will trickle down to things like rents going up, or, you know, who will pay the ultimate buck for that?
Yeah, well, I remember calculating the average property owner in Pitkin County would be paying the equivalent yearly of an extra Netflix subscription in property tax. So it's not immense. And I think that the trickle down effects, once even us renters would see that, it might be even less.
And what a wonderful, wonderfully millennial way of incrementing finances these days.
How much Netflix is this?
Kristen, property owners, I'm sorry. So a lot of the ballot measures were finance-based, and it's interesting because we're underfunded because some quirks in Colorado's legislature. You know, like, people want money that would go to them. People are paying their taxes, but then they get that money right back instead of it going to things like libraries.
Right. We're especially in rural areas or on the Western Slope, we and our special districts are disproportionately sometimes affected by Tabor and by the Gallagher amendments. The Garco Libraries measure was a great example of this, a special district that gets money and then has to refund it to the taxpayers because of Gallagher. That measure did pass, and so they're allowed to keep those funds. There were a lot of special districts throughout Colorado that had measures like this on the ballot to waive the requirements of Gallagher or to help them deal with the effects of Tabor. And I think that in early 2019, we'll actually see the state legislature addressing these issues rather than these kind of piecemeal measures popping up all over Colorado, because it is an issue for lots of places statewide and for lots of entities.
Wyatt, you reported on Proposition 112, which would have changed some rules and regulations for the oil and gas industry. And one argument was, we can't really pare down the oil and gas industry because we do get a lot of our public funding from them paying us taxes. So it was related as well to how do we fund libraries while restricting oil and gas?
Right, and school districts and the county and so forth. Right, so Proposition 112, to remind people, would have required there be a 2,500 foot setback from basically any occupied structure, like a school, like a house, a hospital, and also from water sources. It would have only applied to private land, but in Garfield County, most oil and gas development happens on private land to begin with. So the worry was that if this if 112 had passed, the oil and gas industry basically would be so hamstrung they would just pack up and leave. You know, lots of special districts and lots of parts of our county government get money from property tax, and the businesses paying the highest property taxes in Garfield County are oil and gas companies. So you're exactly right. I mean, the question was, those who were opposed to 112 basically said we would go into another recession if oil and gas companies pack up and leave. That said, there was, you know, people making the public health argument, which was that there are studies that show that there's a correlation between living close to oil and gas development and increased rates of cancer and other kind of medical ailments. So, right, there was kind of the argument. It was between do we kill jobs or do we create public health problems?
Do we kill people?
And neither of those. And of course, it's way more nuanced than that. The way that those arguments are presented is exactly the way that the proponents would want them. It's actually much, much more nuanced. But ultimately, the measure failed, and so it was kind of a moot point.
All right, you are listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. I'm joined with the APR News team, Kristen Kay, Zoe Rome, and Wyatt Orm. We're looking back at the stories from the APR Newsroom in 2018. Stay with us. Back at some of the fun stories of the year too. A lot of what Aspen Public Radio does is bring you that mirror of life in the Roaring Fork Valley, and you've all done really good reporting on that throughout 2018. Zoe Rome, we're talking about the Lake Christine fire, which of course happened while we were in stage 2 restrictions. We had such a low snow season, 17 to 18, and then spring was absolutely dry. So along with increasing fire risk, it also hurt our waterways. And you did a story on how that affects fish. We're going to listen to a little part of that right now.
That's the Roaring Fork River. What is usually a consistent flow has slowed to a trickle this summer. The river lays sluggish in shallow beds like tide pools. Smooth, round river stones that were once completely submerged lie baking in the midday sun. This has been a problem, especially for fishermen.
This is the worst that I've seen in the years that I lived here.
So it's all kind of interrelated, right? So the low snow year and the low rivers year and us having this huge fire, and then things like the economy and people visiting. I think the rivers is a clue as to how things in the valley are going.
Right. Well, the story kind of grew out of some research that the Roaring Fork Conservancy was doing with Colorado Parks and Wildlife, where they were urging fishers to take thermometers, which is a best practice regardless, and measure water temperature as they go out to catch trout. And I thought that was really interesting because you're not supposed to catch trout when the water is above 64 degrees. And I was really curious about, like, why that is, what that does to trout, and how interrelated all these kind of small things are. Like, what does last year's snowpack have to do with the trout that I want to catch this afternoon? And as a Morning Edition host, I was particularly struck by the fact that the voluntary fishing restrictions went into effect in basically from 2:30 in the afternoon to midnight.
And so it was really interesting to dive into
very shallow waters,
to kind of get into what that means for trout and why, you know, these kind of delicate, you know, canaries in the coal mine, as it were, what that can say about last year's snowpack and about our drought conditions, because this these voluntary fishing restrictions are not normal. That doesn't happen in a typical year. And so, you know, how can we draw connections between what's happening in the winters and the effects that we're seeing in the summers, whether it's not being able to catch fish in the afternoon because of the lower, because water's not able to hold as much oxygen and that stresses the fish out, or if it's fire or if it's a bad ski season.
Wyatt, we checked back in with a Valley resident who we met 2 years ago, Sandra Lopez, who has been living in sanctuary because ISA told her, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement told her that she was no longer going to be allowed to stay in the country. So you have a little bit of tape when she found out that she actually would be able to stay in the country and leave sanctuary.
Recently, ICE promised Lopez she won't get deported, at least for now. So she's headed home to Silt. And she tells the crowd through a translator she's thrilled about it.
I'm excited to have normal life, to be able to go to a restaurant with my family.
Police arrested Lopez in 2010 after responding to a domestic disturbance.
So we've met Sandra several times through you, and I want to talk about kind of staying with someone's story, having this one specific story to tell us all, us listeners who have gotten to know her over these years, a bigger story about life here in the Valley.
We first learned about Sandra Lopez in October of 2017, and she was in sanctuary for about 10 months, and that just means that she basically didn't go outside for 10 months. And it was extremely hard on her. It was extremely hard on her children. I can't imagine that it was particularly easy for the family that she was living with. That was the family of Reverend Shauna Foster, who's the minister for the Two Rivers Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Carbondale. And I think my impression was, she went into sanctuary. There was a lot of media attention, including from Aspen Public Radio. She gave a lot of interviews. She was very impassioned. There was a lot of excitement. And then the doldrum and the boredom kicked in.
Yeah.
And she, you know, was in the same house day after day after day. And her family came to visit, and her daughter, Areli, was living with her.
Her very young daughter,
Areli, who, when we started reporting, was 2 and is now 3, I believe. This kind of thing is extremely taxing on a person. And there was a lot of concern from both Reverend Foster and also from Jennifer Smith, Sandra Lopez's attorney, that they weren't sure that she was going to be able to last much longer, just because of psychologically how difficult it is to just remain in one place for so long. 10 months is a really long time. People are typically not in sanctuary for that long. ICE eventually confirmed that she is not a priority for deportation. That does not mean that she no longer has a deportation order. She does. But it means that ICE is not going to be going after her necessarily. But it's just a promise. It's just a promise from ICE. And legally speaking, it's by no means a guarantee. And her legal problems persist, which means she still is in this country without proper documentation. And so really, it's like, you know, we've been reporting on this story, but it'll continue. There's still more coming for Sandra Lopez.
I look forward to hearing updates from her. Kristen, you taught us throughout the year that there is hope in youth. Mm-hmm. Time and time again, we saw that even in the country's most divisive discussions and things like gun control, mm-hmm. There's still people who believe that it will get better, that there will be solutions, that there'll be bipartisan solutions to even our most difficult, divisive things here in the country. And I think your story that exemplifies that the most is when you met with some of the Parkland students who were at Parkland High School the day of the shooting, mm-hmm. in Florida, that really riled up the youth of the country and led to some marches. They came to the Aspen Institute and were watching old protest signs as this new youthful generation who were kind of figuring out protesting on their own. So let me play a little bit of tape and then ask you about that experience.
Like so many others in the U.S., their lives and communities have been forever changed by gun violence. What's different is that these three have joined other teens across the nation in demanding change. Newman says there's nothing special about their motivation.
We got sick of it, so since we got sick of it, we just made sure that no one else had to go through what we had to go through.
We're walking through an exhibit of protest posters from the 1960s and 70s on the campus.
Tell me about these kids. Tell me about meeting them.
I should say, first of all, that two of them were from Parkland, and then Keyshawn Newman, the boy that you heard that quote from, is actually from Chicago. And I love that because it just exemplifies how the Parkland kids reached out to students all over the nation and were like, this isn't just an issue of school shootings. This is gun violence that affects teenagers everywhere. It was really amazing. So they walked around and they looked at the 60s protest posters, and they found so many commonalities between their fight. They do in some ways see similarities between their fight and the fight in the 60s, as far as they think that the government should be held responsible for gun violence just the way they were by protesters in the 60s for the Vietnam War. These students were so smart and articulate and hopeful, but also they were just normal kids. Before our interview, we were talking about what AP classes they were going to be in this year and what they were nervous about for the upcoming year, and it was just typical stuff. And actually, we ended that interview. I asked them, you know, what's the protest art for your movement? We ended up circled around one of their computers while they showed me music videos for songs that are important to them. So it was just a reminder that these are normal people. These are normal students who have gone through abnormal circumstances and who just aren't going to take it anymore, that they have chosen to take action. And it was hopeful. It was something that I heard a lot of people who I admire, I heard interviewed on NPR, like David Sedaris, gave these kids a shout out. I think that they have inspired a lot of adults to fight for change as well.
I was particularly struck by Kristen's story about the Parkland kids, because it just took this really intimate moment and meshed it in kind of this larger national context that we were in. And to me, it was really, really cathartic. And it was really, really, like, it made me feel very optimistic to hear these young people talking about solutions and feelings and the path forward and organizing and, you know, kind of grafting that onto this visiting an art gallery. I thought was really powerful storytelling.
You've been listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtish. I am joined by Kristen Kay, Zoe Rome, Wyatt Orm. We all wish you a very happy new year, a very newsy new year. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everyone.